This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, past and present.
This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters Series.
Hello, Catherine Collett.
That was a long pause, wasn't it?
I don't know if you can sense this coming off me, but I have not yet had my post-festival come down and I'm still quite buzzy. So I'm just trying to like go a little slower and just ground myself a little bit.
How long have you been home?
I got home on Sunday afternoon, Catherine, after, so we last spoke when I was in the midst of the writing residency at Michael King in New Zealand.
Which I still want to hear the tail end of, because you had like festival stuff happening.
The festival stuff was coming. And when I spoke to you, I had not yet done what I set out to do, which was to hand the manuscript to my agent, which, Catherine, I did on the day that I said I was going to.
Did you? So did you, you handed it over from New Zealand or well, you handed I, it yes, over I, when you got back?
I emailed it from New Zealand. One of the really key things that was really important to me, and this came from a few people, but especially our good friend Shay, who reminded me that the magic and serendipity and momentum and glow and creative energy I was feeling would possibly quickly dissipate when I returned home to normal life, which is the normal kind of thing that happens, and that I should do everything within my power to finish it and to get it off. And I worked pretty intensely from when I spoke to you for the next kind of 6 days. I got it printed. It arrived, Catherine. It arrived from the like local printer, wrapped in plastic. So it was like this. Oh. I cried. It was like this real live thing.
So you got it printed for yourself to read?
Myself, because I wanted to do a final read through on paper. I wrote like 30,000 words and I chucked so much. So a lot of it was brand new words. So I knew that I needed to just kind of settle with it. So I marked it up on paper over 2 days and then transferred those edits to the manuscript. And then like in this magical moment, which I have recorded for my own personal posterity, I'm not sure yet whether I will ever share it. I then videoed as the incredible designer that I told you about that I've been working with sent through the final designs just as I had kind of finished typing the end of the manuscript. And I just, it was this enormous file, so it took so long to load. And then I just wept when it came in. And then I just, with total glee, sent it to my agent just saying like, here she is. And then I went down and got a haircut and drank champagne and got my nails done and had a really big swim. And that was it.
Oh, that's so good. When you sent it off, were there any questions in your head that you had been, should I do something this way? Should I do it that way? When you sent it, did you then want to pull any aspect of it back and go, no, I should have done that? Or you sent it and...
That's so interesting. It's so interesting because we often talk about this, that the moment you press send is the moment that you have the kind of aha moment of something that I needed to do. And I'd actually had a really big aha moment the night before, where I'd kind of, because you can do this when you're on a residency, leapt out of bed and made this enormous kind of structural change, and worked out a way to connect two things that hadn't been connected. So I felt deeply resolved, and I really tried to avoid, do you remember how Claire Strawn, were you ever in Claire Strawn's class and she taught us how to say bananas?
She was great.
Before we,
no.
before we shared our work. So I always use this when I'm in writing classes now, that moment that we have when we're about to share work and we want to say, you know, it's first words, it's really crap. Like, I didn't really, I know that this part isn't working, that instead of saying all of that, you just say bananas and it's shorthand. And everyone understands that you're feeling all of that fear and self-loathing and anxiety.
You want to apologize.
Yeah. So I did make some notes to Pippa, to my agent, but I kind of tried to avoid saying all of the things. I just made some notes about kind of formatting stuff that is a bit whack. And anyway, because she is a glorious, radiant human being, I then flew down to Verb, Wellington, which, I mean, we don't even have time to talk about the accolades I am going to give to Verb Wellington. It is the best festival I've ever been to, but hold that thought for a second. We flew down, and on the Friday night, as I sat down to enjoy a cocktail in the hotel lobby, which was more for looks, wasn't kind of my kind of cocktail, a little sweet for me, but it had one of those like smoke bubbles that pops on the top. Oh, and I thought the kids would really enjoy that, right? An email popped into my inbox from my agent saying, I have finished it. And subsequently, without going into all the details, this week on Tuesday, on a very big day, where I was also helping my mum clear out my grandma's house before we sell it, I, in her backyard, which seemed very fitting, and with my agent's, you know, love and urging, I sent it to my publisher. So I am now in waiting mode, as we have all been so many times before. But I just feel, I was thinking this morning, it doesn't feel like a weight has been lifted so much as something has like been extracted from me that has been in me for a very long time. So it feels good, Catherine.
You're in the good part of waiting mode. That's probably what is undersaid about waiting mode. There is a point of waiting mode in the very beginning when you've set something off.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Right? Talk to me in a week or two or seven. Yeah. And the feeling will be different. But right now it feels good.
Now, off air, I am going to ask way more about what your agent said, because I am sure there are lots of lovely things in that email. But I want to know as well, this artistic element, did you send that off to?
Oh, my goodness. I want to show you this so much. So,
I want to see it.
I put it where it fits inside the Word document, I suppose, if that works. And I also attached some higher res files of the thing. And then, being an excited bunny that I am, Eva and I created created this magnificent document of that kind of articulates our collaborative process over the design process through the three phases. And it is, I can't even, it's just the most extraordinary thing.
Is that more for a uni?
No, this was,
would that be for the book?
Yeah, it was very much, it's, you know, it's a bit wild. Like, it feels funny talking about all of this, but stuff it, you know, this is our sixth year in the podcast. Let's be frank. It's a bit wild what I want in the book. And so there was part of me that knew that I needed to be really clear on why I've done it and what I want. And I don't think this is speaking out of turn to say that, did I talk about dinner with Carrie Tiffany?
No.
I happened to be in a gorgeous dinner created by Kate Forsyth and Tony Jordan, and Karen Comer was there, and Kelly Gardner and Carrie Tiffany. And Carrie Tiffany, whom I'd never met before, and I were talking about our projects, and I was talking about the fact that I wanted a diagram in my novel. And she said, I do that all the time. And she said, go in with a really clear intention of what you want. This is your creative vision. So I was like, yes, that is what I want. So I knew that I wanted Eva to create something that I could give to my publisher to say, this is the story behind this thing, and this is why it's really important to me. So I'm thrilled to have that document on so many levels. I think I've probably broken my publisher's brain by sending it to him at the same time as the manuscript, but that's okay. It'll be there for reference as we go on. But it's just been a joy, total joy.
Oh, I love it. Feels like the high has continued.
The high has continued. Can I tell you about Verb?
Yeah, please do. Okay. What makes it so good?
What makes it so good is that it is this warm, generous, inclusive, brilliant programming, and the spatial organization of it means that you can kind of get to everything. It's not a super busy program. I ended up at random things that I didn't think I'd make it to. And the piece de resistance is that on Saturday night, there is a lit crawl, which is free, donation only. So it's very accessible in terms of what you are able to pay. It takes place across this kind of little grid in the middle of Wellington at various events. So I was on with Bad Diaries Salon, where I read my diaries, which was just incredible and so ace. But that was on in Meow, this incredible bar. Then we went on to an apothecary, like a shop that sells oils and stuff, where there was a poetry reading. And people, there was 10 venues or something. And then everyone comes back together, the kind of after party for the whole festival for artists and audience and guests alike. Like this is, there is no hierarchy here. It's not like special people who get in the green room. This is like everyone's invited to just this big old party. Back at one of the venues. And this is where, Catherine, this is where at some point in that party, after the feminist rage and the amazing spoken word poetry and the general hubbub and delight of meeting people and chatting to people, I said to one of the incredible women I'd met, is that Behrouz Bachani sitting over there? Behrouz Bachani being, of course, the incredible writer and journalist and activist who we in Australia locked up indefinitely in Manus for a very long time, but who has been granted residency in New Zealand. And she said, yeah, I reckon it is. And before I could stop myself, being only slightly fueled by a margarita and perhaps a beer, I went over. He was talking to someone and I waited for a lull in the conversation, and the friend was very generous. And I just said, Behrouz, you know, I just wanted to say thank you for all the incredible work you do. And, you know, I apologize on behalf of my stupid country. And the friend generously said, come, you know, speak to Behrouz. At which point we talked for a little bit. Behrouz Bachani has a new book coming out very soon called Freedom, Only Freedom. And he is at the moment trying to get his visa to come to Australia to launch that book and celebrate it. And I said, because it was an after party and because I was feeling fairy festival buzzy, I said, well, I have a podcast and we'd love to interview you and talk about your book. Like, would that be something? Yes, he said, sure. He's like, contact me on WhatsApp right now and let's do that. And then he said, you know what though? You should interview me now. You should start now. And Catherine, you can only imagine, like, I said, Behrouz, I can't do that. Like, I need to prepare for an interview. I need to read the book. Like, I can't possibly do that right now. And he said, you should capture this moment. Just start recording it now on your phone. So in my possession, I now have the 12-minute recording, you know, filled with, I don't know what you're going to do about this, Phoebe, filled with thudding bass underneath us because we were sitting next to the stage, of me interviewing Behrouz Bachani about his work and why it's important to him and the extraordinary ridiculousness of the questions he's answering at the moment to try and get a visa into Australia. And like,
I feel like this is the perfect segue. You have to play this now. Or are you saving it?
We'll save it and hopefully we will have a chance to talk to Behrouz. But, you know, I thought that the volcano was my highlight. Then I thought that Eric Bogle was my highlight. Then I thought that handing my manuscript in was my highlight. And then I got to interview Behrouz Bachani at the after party. And
you got to stop.
Am I making it hurt? Sorry.
It's hurting. It's just starting to ache.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No, I'm extremely, extremely happy for you. I'm very glad for you too that you've sent this manuscript off because I know there's been a lot of work to the finish line.
Thank you.
And it would be really sad to get home from such a massive retreat and buzz of excitement and not to have done that one thing. So that's ace. Congratulations.
Thank you. Let's go and listen to our featured book segment just so I can calm down a little. This is with Anna Snookstra and she's brilliant. T Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Harlequin Fiction, and we are delighted to be talking to Anna Snookstra about her new book, Out of Breath. Anna is an award-winning author and screenwriter who lives in Naarm, Melbourne. She's the author of Only Daughter, Little Secrets, and The Spite Game. Her novels have been published in over 20 countries and 16 languages. She's written for The Guardian, Meanjin, and Lit Hub, and has had short fiction published in the Saturday Paper and the Griffith Review. Her new novel, Out of Breath, is out right now, and her first audio drama, This Isn't Happening, is out with Audible in early 2023. Anna, welcome to the First Time Podcast.
It's very surreal and very exciting to be here. I'm very happy.
Oh, I'm so glad. Anna, to begin, can you please give us the pitch for Out of Breath?
It's so funny. I always feel like I only get the pitch right once the book is like, once you're up to the next book. But yeah, so it's basically, it's about a young British woman. She kind of goes through a messy breakup in Sydney, and she has to do, so in order to get your second working holiday visa, by law, Australia has people do 88 days of seasonal work. So she goes to work on a mango farm in Broome, which is very much outside of her experience of being like in a kind of ex-mining small Midlands town in England. And she meets a lot of people there, and it's a very, very different environment, and ends up getting involved in a kind of off-the-grid community that's living by the coast, that has lots of secrets that she uncovers.
You've said that you like to write books that scare you, and this one totally scared me and compelled me. I said on Instagram and mentioned to you that I read it very breathlessly over two train trips on the one evening and just could not put it down. I wanted to ask how you use your own kind of scare factor in the way that you propel your writing and the narratives that you're writing as well.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I love doing that because I think it's a good way to face your fears in like a really very, very safe way. And when I write it, it takes the air out, and it makes it almost, for me, kind of funny. Like I start writing scariest bits and they're just so full on that I'm kind of sitting there like giggling when I'm writing them, and it totally takes away that fear. But for this one, there's so much there, but a lot of stuff has been very lost and very out of control on a more emotional level, but also physically deep water can be a very, very scary thing, and drowning which comes into play in this book in quite a big way, as well as working on a farm would be pretty shit as well. I wouldn't like that.
So let's talk about that deep water and the working on a farm. You wrote an article for Kill Your Darlings called Method Writing and the Limits of Research that is about your research process for this book and what you discovered. Can you tell us a little bit about the research that you thought you had to do and the research that you did do, and what you talk about in that article, which we will link to in the show notes for our listeners as well?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty, the whole thing was kind of funny, but basically I was in a relationship with a guy that went and did this farm work. He was English, and we ended up being almost like a halfway house for these guys, and had all these, we were living in a big share house, and we had all these housemates who were coming and going doing this farm work, and every time they came back, they came back with these pretty full-on stories about just horrible things. Some of it was amazing as well, like there is positive experiences that come from it too, but on the whole, just really being taken advantage of, one of them was living in a shed with no running water or electricity or anything, and it was like bunk beds in a shed, and they were being charged like $250 a week and things like that, as well as things that were a bit more violent. And so I thought, I need to write a book about this, people need to know about this, and I also just thought it was quite a, I don't know, evocative potential for a story of someone who's a really real outsider coming into an environment like that, literally from different countries, often really city focused people who just don't know how to do that kind of work, coming into those environments. And I was imagining as a woman as well, coming into that, very, very vulnerable. So I went really hard into the research. I did just huge amounts of interviewing And some of the stories were just crazy. One that always sticks out is the one where he found that the where he was staying was he was by himself was just absolutely riddled with little video cameras. He's been filmed. And he still had to stay there for the night because there's no like mobile phone reception or anything like that. Yeah, so all these stories. And then I started thinking, you know, the best way for me to research is I have to be a method writer and I have to go and do the farm work, which was pretty silly after hearing so many negative stories. And some of them were like a lot of sexual assault and things like that as well going on. So I was trying, I got invited to come and work on an apple orchard. And I was so excited and I thought, oh, this is really embarrassing. And I think it's good to just embrace this kind of, you can be quite foolish in some ways. And I thought, oh, I'll put an accent on so they believe me. And then if I'm going to be there for 3 months with an accent, it's just like, this is so silly. And plus my accents, I sound ridiculous. I can't do it. You'd have to be pretty good at it. But yeah, so I went there, but what I kind of had already knew about a little bit, and which I really saw there is often it's the hostels that play a big part in exploiting these workers. So they get people to come promising them work because often there's not enough work for the people who want to extend their visas, and there actually isn't any work. So they bring you there, they charge you huge amounts for accommodation, and then you just wait and wait and wait and the work doesn't come. Yeah, which ended up being what was going on in this situation. So I was very happy to leave and not actually have to do 3 months of farm work while living in a shipping container.
How did you reconcile that moment where you realised, okay, I'm going to let this go now. I don't have to because I think you say in that article too, it can be very safe to stay in the research and not to get on the page. So how did you kind of push through that moment and really go, okay, now it's time for me to serve the narrative and my characters?
Well, I think part of the problem I was having was that I was really struggling to write. And with my other books, I found it a lot easier just to get into it and to write. And I felt like there was a real problem. And I think I had this feeling, I know that sometimes when you read books, you can feel when the author's loving it. You can feel that fun that's coming through. And so I was really worried that the opposite was true. And because I was struggling to write it, that therefore the reader would feel that. And so then I was trying to do things to stop that struggle. And I have to say, it was actually an interview on your podcast, and I mean this, that really helped me through that. And it was James Bradley who wrote The Resurrectionist and was talking about how the book was just so broken and that it was just such a struggle, like every sentence was just such a struggle, and that in the end the book did really well. And that just filled me with so much hope because I just was so sure that the fact that it was so hard meant something was broken in it and that people would feel it, but in fact it's not true. And so then I started thinking the opposite. Oh, maybe the fact that it's so hard means it's going to be the best book I've ever
yes.
written. And it means that it must be like, yeah, this fantastic thing that I'm trying to capture. So then when I jumped into that and just embraced that, it somehow got a lot easier. I think it just took the pressure off. And I think that while you can feel it when people are having that fun when they write, I also think it doesn't, the way you write the book doesn't really necessarily come through in the way it's read. I don't, people when they read it haven't said that they can feel that kind of awkwardness or frustration coming through. So and I found that really freeing, that it kind of is not necessarily connected. So if it's, no matter how you're finding it, it doesn't, like I've written a book and I had the most fun writing it, but then people read it and they go, this is just a big pile of poo. So, yeah.
You know, that's so interesting and I'm so glad an interview helped. And I think that two people I've spoken to recently, Margot Lanigan for the podcast and Jane Harper for an event, both talked about that idea that if you're having a crap writing day or you're having a good writing day and you go back later and you look at the words that you did on either of those days, you cannot tell the difference. So I think that speaks to that same thing too, that the process can be very different. Anna, you mentioned the word evocative before, and that is exactly what your books are. And Out of Breath in particular, just that Kimberley landscape, it's such a sensory overload. I know that from being there, but I also really felt that in the book. And that extends to some of that diving stuff, certainly being on the farm, the heat, and also some pretty great sex scenes. So I want to ask, or sexy scenes, should I say. So I just wanted to ask about how you come to the page to do that kind of sensory writing. How do you evoke those feelings?
I love writing sex scenes or sexy scenes. I love it. Some people really don't like it. I love it.
I have to pull myself back.
You like it?
Yeah. I do.
Yeah. Sometimes I have to pull myself back because it's just people like, Anna, this is not an erotic novel. Like, calm down. So I was trying to not go too hard. Some of my other books are a bit more intense. And actually a bookseller told me once, she's like, your sex scenes are some of the hottest I've ever read. And that was like the best compliment.
It is. And also what you should pull out and put as a quote on, you know, exactly, the front of all of your books. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, the sensory, I mean, I think especially for, as you say, the landscape, the Kimberley, it's so overwhelming on so many levels because it's so humid. And also just the colours are just so, so intense and so saturated. And because I was trying to write it from a real outsider perspective, and being honest, I mean, I am an outsider to that area as well. I grew up in Canberra. It's pretty different. From an English person's perspective, who just, you know, has never seen anything like this before, I just felt like it made it really easy. I didn't really have much trouble with that. It just felt really natural. And I went there as part of the research as well, and kind of, what I actually did was, by then I'd written the book, and then I kind of retraced the steps of the character. I'd been there once before, and that was the weirdest feeling, because it was like I'd imagined the place, and I'd imagined all these things, and then I was going to these places that started to feel like, for years they'd just been playing out of my head. It was bizarre. But yeah, I mean, it's just the place. I mean, I just don't know how you could write about it without it feeling really sensory.
Mm. I want to just ask quickly about the idea of, you know, you've described what you write as psychological thrillers. In Out of Breath, there is a kind of a backstory too that you're moving between with your character. What are some of the things that you keep in mind about the genre and the structure and the form that you're writing when you're doing a thriller like this, that you know you want to keep the reader absolutely hooked onto the page at all times?
Yeah, I mean, this one actually is a big, it doesn't really fit into the thriller mold at all. I think that hopefully there's tension that goes through it, and that was something more in editing that I had to make sure that tension remained through it, but it's not really got a core, you know, mystery. You know, it doesn't start with like a dead body or start with you know, someone going missing or any of that kind of thing. It's really, I mean, it's got real thriller elements, I guess.
It really does.
But on the whole, I would say it's actually would fit more into kind of, it's almost like a journey book, like a Bildungsroman type situation. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I was going for more. It was one of those books, my other books I think fit into the thriller genre a bit more neatly. And this one, it just was what it wanted to be. And I kind of had to just let go and go with it. But yeah, I was kind of interested in that. That kind of quest narrative that you see, and it's usually quite masculine and male, and Emily Bitto does it in a really interesting way in Wild Abandon. But I was interested in, yeah, taking it from a woman's perspective, kind of that journey of self-discovery and in a place where she just absolutely shouldn't be and doesn't belong on any level. Was fun and interesting, and then they've marketed it. It's funny when the marketing and the book, I mean, people have said they found it, has a lot of tension and stuff, but they've marketed it as like a straightforward thriller, and doesn't necessarily fit that completely.
Yeah, the things we learn about our own books when they hit marketing always surprise me. Talking about writing different things, you've got a new Audible original coming out next year. How did the process of writing that differ?
I had so much fun writing that. It was awesome. So my background is kind of more screenwriting. So this was like the perfect combination. I've always wanted to write a radio play, and then I realized radio plays, I mean, they're not really, I mean, this is, I guess, the new version of a radio play.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was so much fun. It was actually originally a script, a short film script. But there was so much going on inside the character's head that so it didn't really quite work as a short film script. And then my agent told me that the Audible was looking for female-focused psychological thrillers with lots of twists. which kind of felt like a bit of a challenge. I wrote it just after my daughter was born, and I just needed something because I was just at home all the time, and you know, felt like you can just get so lost in that period of like, you know, you would know your identity kind of gets thrown away. So something that was just like a small, easy kind of challenge. And so I said, okay, they want a psychological thrill, lots of twists. And so I was like kind of in my head going through, okay, how many twists can I put in this thing? 3, 4? And yeah, so it's kind of, it's about this couple, or that they're kind of exes and they go on this date. And so you get the dialogue of them talking on this date, but also you get her thoughts as well. Which is completely conflicting with what's happening, which was really fun as well to write. So I got my friends over and we did like a read through, like we had like a nice dinner and did a read through, which was just, yeah, so, so much fun.
Oh, that is brilliant. That's the best process story. I love that. And I look forward to listening to it too. Anna, you teach writing as well as being a writer, and you've got this diverse experience across screenwriting and novel writing. What is some of the best writing advice that you've either received or you can give to other writers who are listening?
Yes, I would say, honestly, perseverance 100% is just, it's so hard to keep reminding yourself to do that. And I think that perseverance as a new writer, when you're, you know, trying to get your foot in the door, but also when you're being published. And I think that something I found really interesting and often doesn't get spoken about is that your career usually doesn't go from that first debut, which gets all the splash, and then up and up and up and up, and you hope it does. Some people it does, and that's fantastic. But often it kind of has books that don't quite click, and then other ones that do well in ways you wouldn't expect. And, you know, when you talk about this on the podcast, like what does success mean? And it can look really different for different books. And I was listening to an interview with Jean Hank-Horowitz, who wrote The Undoing, that was that Nicole Kidman show. And then her new book, The Plot, I just loved. But she'd written like 10 books before that, and then just suddenly it broke through on book number 10. It was just crazy. But yeah, just that perseverance on every level of your career, and just understanding that, yeah, it's a roller coaster. Someone told me, yeah, perseverance is as important as talent when I was in writing school. And I think that's so true, because I know so many people who have beautiful, beautiful novels and they don't show it to publishers and agents and get it out there. And it's so tragic because they have so much talent. So yeah, perseverance would be just, yeah, what I would say. Because, yeah, you can have all the talent in the world, but if you don't keep pushing and get some of that rejection, then, you know, it's just going to stay on your computer, unfortunately.
Oh, that's a good fighting vibe to go into everyone's writing session for the day. Anna, can you recommend for us a debut book, anytime, any genre?
Well, I'll do a recent one, which was, I don't know if you've read it, Adrienne Howe, Hydra.
Oh, I haven't read it yet. It's on my list.
Yeah, I bet your list is massive. Yeah, it came out maybe 2 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, really recent. It's a very odd book, which I love. It's set in the Mornington Peninsula about a woman who was in antiques, and then things have gone really badly and she's moved into this kind of little cabin on the Mornington Peninsula. But there's something really odd about the book, which I really like. In some ways it's quite, there's some really scary parts to it, but it's also very offbeat and quite funny in other parts. And just the character is such an oddball and got such a hilarious kind of outlook on what's going on around her that I just adored. So, yeah, I would definitely recommend that one. And I'm so interested to see what she writes after this.
Fantastic. Hydra, I'm looking forward to it. And Anna, I know you've got some events coming up. Where can people find you talking about Out of Breath?
Yeah, I've got a few, and maybe we'll have a few more soon. So me and Eliza Henry Jones have like organised this little kind of journey together, because her book Salt and Skin, we did little blurbs for each other's books, and then we were talking, there's so much in common between these books, it's just so strange. So we're doing Book Lovers Fest, which is in November at Eltham Library. We're doing the Phillip Island Book Festival We're doing the Mansfield Book Festival as well. And I think there'll be a few more. There's a few that are kind of in the works. We might go to Canberra. I'm hoping to go to Canberra, back to my roots.
That is so exciting. I can't let you go without asking. Is this something that you two worked out independently, just together independently of your publishers and then got their support? Or how did you do that?
Yeah, well, that's the thing that I've really learned. So when I published my first book, I was just like, here you go, publishers. Like, send this out. You know, I expected them to do all the marketing, everything. And that meant that I could just relax and I didn't have to keep pushing anymore. But I've learned that that's just so not true. And it can be true if that's what you want. But yeah, you can reach out yourself. So we reached out to a bunch of libraries and things like that. So I teach at RMIT, but over the summer I've got heaps of time and we thought it could be quite fun. And I thought it'd be cheaper doing it, but they responded really well. And apparently it's fine. You're allowed to do that, which I didn't know.
I love it. There are no rules. Well, there are some rules, but most of them you're allowed to break. That's fantastic. Yes. We will link to those events so that people can find you. And I'm just so thrilled about Out of Breath, and I hope that it keeps many other readers on the train reading it without putting it down. And I so look forward to hearing your new one from Audible as well.
Thank you. Thanks so much. It's been so much fun.
Thank you for speaking to us. So, Catherine, before we get into our recommendations and what we've been listening to and reading and watching, do you realize that this is the second last time that we are catching up for the podcast this season?
I do. I think the word is, well, does penultimate apply?
Penultimate does apply. It does. It is penultimate.
Such a specific word.
I was kind of thrown by that because I don't know what day it is at the moment or what month. And so I'm feeling a little emotional about that, but that's okay because we've got exciting things coming up.
We do. We've got a summer series coming up. Whoop. So this is going to be a summer series of repeats. What did they used to call them? I think in the 90s they had clip shows where they would do that episode within a season where they would clip things together and they were widely panned. We're not going to do that. We're going to pick out – well, we can either do it on data. We also have some of our favourite episodes, but we want to put it out to listeners as well.
Yeah. Yeah. We want to hear – if you cast your mind back over the last 5 years, and if you have been a rusted on listener to us, it's a terrible phrase, isn't it? Rusted on.
If you've never used that phrase.
No, ever. I don't think I have until right then. So if you've been a passionate listener, and you might think about episodes that deserve a second airing, you know, we'll zhuzh them up a bit. Take out anything that Catherine and I said.
Some of those early ones probably need a bit of shushing. Though we will finish. I think we can say this. We are going to finish with our very first episode.
We are.
Which will be a nice intro into some of the changes that are happening next season.
Absolutely. Because, and this is also really important, we like to be all about transparency. And we have a great new segment coming up next year, which we're not going to tell you all about. But we are going to say this. We are already booking our spots for next year. If you are an author with a book coming out in 2023, your publisher, if it is an Australian publisher, has our information about how to get on the First Time podcast. But what we know is that if you want to be on the podcast and you tell your publisher, you have a higher chance of making that happen. And we know people slip through the cracks and we know publishers are very busy and there's lots of people doing lots of things, but we are filling up and it's kind of anxiety provoking already, but there's already lots of spots filled with 2023 books. So, check in with your publisher or get in contact with us because we have definitely followed up on people who have contacted us on Twitter or on Instagram or sent us an email, and we see those. And we note them down in one of many spreadsheets and it helps. Would you say it helps?
Yeah, it helps. Yeah. It helps a lot. I think that it's also a normal thing to do.
Like yes.
It can feel pushy, but I think it's pretty normal.
It's not pushy.
Pitches from debut authors right through to authors that have had multiple books and we can't even believe they're emailing us.
Yeah. So it's not weird. It's not weird.
Very normal.
Can I begin with what I've been listening to? Because I feel like it will segue into something. I listened to on the train on the way home last night your superb interview with Heather Rose, and it was so good. And I was like, I'm going to take notes. And then I went, I don't have to take notes because eventually we'll do the transcript. So that's okay. But it was just really a beautiful interview. So thank you.
Thank you. She is the most lovely person. Immediately, like just a real pleasure of a person to talk to in general, but also someone who is a great writer. Mm. This book that she has most recently written, Nothing Bad Ever Happens Here, it's memoir. It is a little bit like hearing you talk about the festival in the sense that she's someone who really has lived a life. Like you sort of read the book and walk away from it inspired to just be in the world and I think see the world but be still in the world. Mm. She does stuff like she I think somewhere in Australia she does this sweat lodge thing, which is like a Native American type semi-spiritual thing. Anyway, so she does that. I think she's in her 20s at the time. Then she starts having this dream that this wolf is visiting her. I'm probably paraphrasing a bit and not getting all of the details right. Anyway, so she starts having these dreams that this wolf is visiting her. So then she goes back to the sweat lodge people and says, I keep having these dreams. And they said, you're being invited to do the Sundance. So she goes to America to do this Sundance, which is also a Native American thing. It's in the desert. It involves sweat lodges. It involves like pretty extreme ripping of skin. You can't eat. Wow. It's a bit hallucinogenic. So this wild stuff in there. But then there's also things like she goes to a monastery and lives there and considers never leaving. She goes on this long walk with her 14-year-old son, which, as you can imagine, is both beautiful and deeply irritating at times as well. I really love that book and I really, really love talking to her. She was great.
You could tell. And I've got the book sitting here on my pile and I'm very much looking forward to reading it. What else
is it? It's a good one. Shuffle it up to the top. Alan C. Jones's book is the other book I'm reading at the moment. Ooh. Her Death Was Also Water. Are you familiar with this book?
No, I'm not.
It's so interesting. So he, I think, is American or Canadian background writer, but he's in Australia. I'm doing an event with him at Eltham Bookshop next Thursday. Which is your part of the woods. It's
link in the show notes about Thursday the 17th.
Link in the show notes. So it's a book about, and it's not a book that I had actually heard much about, but it's really interesting. It's about seven people who there is a flood and they end up on a boat. So they're based, it is a boat that feels both current in terms of climate change, but also a bit biblical as well.
Yeah, right.
Like it's a really, really extreme flood. What is so great about it is it's seven perspectives, so each chapter is a different perspective. I think that is such a hard thing to do. I tried in the competition with lots of different perspectives, so it's something that I read a lot of books very closely looking at how people did it. So Leanne Moriarty does ensemble typecasts really well, but she will move from person to person within the one scene. She's really good at very artfully like just shifting. It's chapter by chapter, but it's so fluid. Like he has that same fluidity of Leanne Moriarty. And I keep trying to work out how he's done it so well. I think part of it is it's condensed space and condensed time. But I think it's also voice. Sometimes when you have multiple points of view, the sense of distinction between characters can feel so labored. His is so subtle in almost the rhythm of the line. Like it's subtle differences, but you're so fully present in each person. It's brilliant. There is in particular this one character who's very kind of a young man, extremely misogynistic and kind of a beefcake bodybuilder type. My body just viscerally, like the feeling of reading him is almost difficult because he's so revolting, but it's wonderful too. It is just such an unexpected book. I'm enjoying it so much. It's great.
Oh, that's brilliant. I so look forward to that conversation in Eltham. Nice.
Did you bring a third suitcase of books home from people you read?
Look, I didn't buy another suitcase, but I did manage to get my excess baggage down as I was putting the bags on from $156 down to $44 by taking a bunch of books out of one bag and just carrying them on in another bag. But there's two of them that I, three of them that I really want to talk about. Like New Zealand writers, Aotearoa, just like my mind is blown. How to Loiter in a Turf War by Coco Solid, who's an incredible.
What a great title, though.
Right. And just I heard Coco speak. I was on opening night with her, and then I heard her in conversation talking about this book. Also goes by the name Jessica Hansel, just a multidisciplinary, incredible artist, Māori woman. And I've started reading this, and it is just so damn good. So I'm super excited about reading that and just following whatever Coco Solid does, you know, for the rest of her life, because that was really, really incredible. One of the things that I found overwhelming and incredible, and I think contributed to how warm and generous Verb Wellington was, is how much of it was conducted in Te Reo Māori, which is the language, the Māori language, so that often a session would start and there might be 10 or 15 minutes in Māori language before anyone said a word of English. And, you know, many people in the audience understood some of those words. Many, like me, understood very little. But it was just this very powerful kind of way to be as a Pākehā woman and, you know, one not from New Zealand as well, as foreign one as well. So that was really extraordinary. And the other person who I was on with on opening night and also heard speak separately is Dr. Hinamoa Elder, who's a psychiatrist, incredible Māori woman. And this is her second book, maybe. It's based on the cycles of the moon. And so, like, very fitting for this week when we had our blood moon and solar eclipse. And on every day, it basically gives you kind of a reading of what the moon is doing that day and how that contributes to your energy. And it is great. And it is, like, mostly the sections that I've read. And this is very fittingly, she signed the day that I met her, which was kind of basically said, you are at your sexual peak today.
Really?
And most of the, they all have this like incredible kind of female energy. It's all based around kind of Māori story and culture. And it is just, I'm enjoying it. I'm doing that kind of thing, which I don't regularly do, where I pick it up every day and I read what that kind of energy is. But I highly recommend Dr. Hinamoa Elder. And she's on, you can find her on Instagram. We'll put links in as well. And then the last person, you know, on the, you know, you think, I'm not going to do anything on the last day. I'm just going to like sort myself out. I'm going to get on that plane. I'm going to pack my bags. But then I saw that Kate DeGoldy, who is a YA writer who I read, you know, earlier in my life, she was speaking about her new book called Eddie Eddie. And I know that people like Penny Russin are huge fans of Kate DeGoldy. And I heard her speak and she was just exquisite, like exquisite in that way that I went, I have already know I've got 10 kilos of excess luggage, but I cannot leave without buying this book. And what she did, which was really extraordinary, one of the things I've taken notes, she talked about a pivotal moment that this book took 10 years to write. She's in her 60s, very long career, fruitful career. And she talked about this pivotal moment when she understood what the book was meant to be. And she said, and I quote, the novel's coordinates opened up at that point. And I loved that. And it just, it felt like what I'd experienced during the residency. And it felt like that moment that sometimes we hear authors tell us about, like when they understood what the book was meant to be, or they made that kind of shift. And I thought that was a beautiful way of kind of thinking about it, because hers is very place-based as well. And the other thing that she talked about, this book, Eddie Eddie, is about kind of found family and kin. And one of the other things that I scribbled down is what she said. It's hard to be sufficient as two parents, is what she wrote. And I was almost in tears at this stage. She acknowledged, of course, that many people are in a situation when they are just parenting solo as well. But just the idea that you need a village and that kids need other grown-ups, be it teachers or coaches or family friends or other people in their space where they can grow and learn to be themselves. And I think, look, let's be honest, I was being impacted emotionally by the fact that I was 3 weeks away from kids at that stage and desperate to get home, and also keenly aware of the my gratitude to like the entire village that has helped support Adam, you know, in my absence looking after the kids. But it was just a really lovely kind of way that she talked about that other kin, and it made me want to buy the book, which I went and did.
Such a lovely note to end on too. Mm. Like tenuous link, but feels semi-related. I am still listening to Esther Perel's Where Shall We Begin? But one of the, it's just obsessive listening. It feels so voyeuristic, but also I can see why she does it. Like it's more than just having people listen in. Like it's such an empathy creating kind of exercise. But the couple that I listened to most recently were I think they were from different backgrounds. Anyway, one was sort of talking about I think she was Sudanese was her background, and the priority that community is given in life versus one who has sort of had a more conventional American background, which is much more individualistic. Mm. But such an interesting tension for a couple.
Mm.
Oh, it, yeah. I won't do it justice in explaining, but I cannot get enough of listening to these conversations. She's such a artful, I don't even know if that's the right word, but just the questions that she asks and the prodding and the way that she can take you down an avenue is incredible. Like
I truly feel that your combination of deep love and obsession with reality television and perhaps this same kind of there's some thread in there towards the voyeuristic nature of Esther Perel. I feel like there is some heat in here for you for some kind of novel or project which will come out for you in the future, because I want to read your takes on all of this stuff that you consume. I love it.
I think there is something coming, but I don't know what it is. But do you know when you get that feeling?
Yes.
I think there is something. There is a lot of interesting analysis of reality TV happening at the moment, I think, like a revisiting.
You have an excited face on. Yeah. It's your excited face. Tell me what you're watching, segue.
One book, though, that I just wanted to mention because I forgot, which is not the type of book we ever, I don't think we've ever talked about this type of book on the podcast.
I'm so interested to know what you're about to say because I feel like we've talked about
it
a lot.
It is. I'm going to hold it up. The Tin Eats Recipe Book. Do you follow Tin Eats?
No, but you I don't think we've ever talked about a recipe book.
Maggie May Hashi, Tin Eats is like just this recipe website, but she's such a good Instagram follow. I love nothing more alongside reality TV than watching a recipe be created on Instagram that takes me from chopping vegetables to a made lasagna within 30 seconds. So she does a lot of that. But her recipes are ace. I think this is the best recipe book I've ever read in that I could make every recipe. I would happily take it with me to a restaurant, and I really have wished many times these types of restaurants existed where I could take my recipe book and just say, this is actually what I want. Like, I know you specialize in, fried potatoes, but I want this. I
love you. That is
so great. How good would that be?
That would be great. Also,
it would be.
I fear we're about to be inundated with recipe books now.
But yeah,
that was outside of our lane before, and now
it was totally
in our lane.
Outside of the lane. What have I been watching? Oh, one thing that I've been watching that I think is ace, it's a kids' show. I've been watching it with the kids. The Mysterious Benedict Society. Ooh. Have you watched this?
No, but I've heard about it. It's been recommended.
It's really, really good. So it's based on, I think maybe there are four or five books in the series. They are for kids. The premise or the starting premise is that you have this particular, I think it's framed as an academy in the beginning, but that ends up being a trick. And you have all of these kids from all over trying out to be selected to be part of this academy. So they go through all of these tests. And eventually you get this group of kids that are selected. They're all orphans and they each have a special skill. It's just such a lovely show to watch. It satisfies kids. Kids are engaged. I sat down for about 2 minutes to sort of fake watch intending to leave. I couldn't move away. Yeah, great, great family viewing, The Mysterious Benedict Society. Really love good.
It. Adding it to the list. Maybe I can stop my children just watching NBA replays just for a moment. Hey,
that feels like semi-educational.
Oh, it is, but just it's a lot. At the risk of being, again, a total kind of inspo wanker, I was going to say that I didn't watch anything on the plane on the way home, which my children were kind of aghast at. Like, What do you mean, Mum?
How many hours?
Four. Could have watched two movies. Nice. I mean, there was Thor, Love and Thunder right there. Etta was like, "What? Are you serious, Mum?" Not only did I not watch anything nor listen to anything, for the first time in my entire adult life, I did not partake of a gin and tonic on the plane. Just let them go past. Are you sure you don't want anything? No, no, thank you. I'm fine. Like, and I think it was this. I was so at capacity, at like maximum fill point of words and experiences and thought. I didn't necessarily sleep. I kind of dozed and tried really hard to pinpoint where we were on the Tasman because there were some weird islands that came up and I wasn't sure where they were. But anyway, so I wasn't watching anything. I wasn't listening to anything. I wasn't reading anything. I wasn't eavesdropping. And in the middle of the flight, just like that, bang, I woke up or kind of came up from dozing and had the perfect word for word end to the picture book that, you know, that I've been working on for a bit. Different ending completely. Wrote it down in my phone, kind of dozed back off, came home, whacked it in the manuscript, it fits. And what it made me realize was that generally here in normal life, I go around with like basically a podcast in one ear, something on my phone in the other, like just busy, busy, give me all the stuff, like content, 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 get it in me immediately. But that what I did when I was away was that I didn't. I had quiet, heaps, like just heaps and heaps of quiet. And that
I think it's not rushing
as
well, not having to rush and not having to be like, I've got 3 hours quickly.
Yeah, yeah. So it was a really super reminder to me about what can come out of the quiet. So that's what I wasn't watching.
That's pretty awesome. I think I just hit peak jealousy in the, I was on the plane, I refused alcohol and didn't watch TV, and the end of my picture book came to me.
You're allowed to hate on me all you like, and you can play this back to me at some point in the future.
I'll cut it.
Oh, Meldon Hall, are you serious? You've got this event coming up next week. Tell us the details again.
So the details are, it's coming up on Thursday, 17th of November. It's at Eltham Bookshop. Bookings are online. I think it starts at 6:30.
Perfect.
I'm hoping I don't have to bring my children. Please let me not have to bring my children.
Well, anyway, if you do, I'll take them next door and you can tell them that there is a very good ice cream shop.
Is right there?
Next door to Eltham Bookshop.
I love that. They'll want to come.
Yeah. I'll be your backup. I'll take them there if it's going crazy. I have something coming up in Sydney. I get to go to Sydney and I'm doing a new workshop for Writing New South Wales. It's on Wednesday, the 23rd of November. It's an evening event. It's called Talking the Talk. And I'm so excited about it. It's about all the stuff that you have to do when you're talking about your novel, when you're pitching it, if it's coming out, when you're in the world, if you're doing interviews, if you're being a guest.
Perfect.
If you're being a host, if you turn up at the after party and you don't know who to talk to, how do you do the thing? So I'm super, super excited about it. It's all brand new stuff that I haven't done before. So the booking link is in the show notes. And, yeah, come along. Sydney sided.
That is a great fit for you.
It is perfect. A good fit.
Learning from an expert. I love it.
See you for our last conversation in a couple of weeks.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.